My mother, who is a great pastry cook, fantastic. She makes, used to make, I'm trying to make them now, I've nearly got them right, spiral biscuits, snail biscuits, chocolate and pastry.
A little bit Rogalachy.
Yeah, yeah. I can show you a photograph because I had to send my sister a photograph of what I'd done. We were working simultaneously in different cities. Mm-hmm. And she made them beautifully. And one afternoon tea, when all the neighbours and friends were around, her neighbour said, she said, "I don't have time to make things like this, Betty." And my mother said darkly, "She's got time to eat them."
Oh, zing! What year was that?
This would have been 70s.
Oh my God! As editor of the Good Food Guide throughout the 80s and 90s, I told Rita she really required very little introduction, but she didn't seem to agree.
There are lots of people who don't know who I am.
Really?
Yeah. Most people under 30. Who's she?
Oh, Rita. They don't know. They don't know.
They weren't there.
They weren't there. And that's, you know what, I think that actually, I think that quote that you gave me on the phone, that was like, if you think that the 70s was about pineapple and jelly, you weren't there. I love that. There's no point trying to imagine what people ate in the 70s when you can just ask the person that not only cooked her own dinner parties, but set the menu for others. And lucky for us, she wrote it all down.
So in the 70s, I was working, I'd lived in London for a bit, came back to Australia, and then I was working in newspapers. So this was just private stuff. This was private dinners and cooking for friends and, in a funny way, teaching myself how to cook, because I look back on the dinners I recorded, and I look back on dishes I made again and again over a couple of months or 3 months, 4 months, and I know what I was doing. I was perfecting the recipe. Mm. I was getting it out of my head and into my hands.
Mm. And you had plenty of opportunity, because how often were you having people over for dinner?
I'd have to look through the book, but often, I mean, because it was often informal. It was often about saying to people, "So what are you doing tonight, or what are you doing tomorrow night? Come round for a meal." Mm. And sometimes it was the big kind of putting people together and making something special for dinner. And I recorded who came, what we drank. The notes aren't faultless, I have to tell you. I'm not that obsessive. So there are gaps, but I can see we drank a lot of a Cabernet. That was interesting. And this was the time when the Yarra Valley was going through its great revival, so there was a lot of good wine around. Good wine from Coonawarra too, I can see from my notes. And I recorded if people got on or not.
Rita, it's just crazy to me to think that you have not only like a small record, but I'm looking at, Rita's told me I'm not allowed to take photos of the inside pages, but I'm certainly going to share what the book looks like on the outside. But it's essentially a time capsule in words. So when's the first entry? What year was that?
The first entry was, I mean, the other lovely thing is that it's all falling apart now.
Yeah, which means it's legit.
It was 75.
Yep.
Christmas Eve, 75.
So we're smack bang in the middle of the 70s. And of course, the reason why we're talking about dinner parties in the 70s is because of Abigail's Party. And we're both very much looking forward to checking that out opening night.
Oh, we are indeed.
But here we are, it's 1975, Christmas Eve with Rita Ehrlich. What did you cook?
Oh, goodness, I've trimmed this back a bit. we had, as an antipasto table, and I still do this, pate, I must have made it, grilled red peppers, Polish sausage that would have come from Vic Market, olives, pickled figs and artichokes that I would have made myself.
Rita, that menu could be from last night.
It could be. Then we had avgolimoni,
So lemon chicken soup.
Lemon chicken soup. Delicious. Lemon with rice. And then, oh, now this is dating me entirely because I've never made this again. Bœuf en croûte. But I haven't recorded where I got the meat or where I got the pastry or did I make it. And a green salad with lots of fresh herbs. And then we had blue Castello cheese. And that cheese is something we need to talk about because this records what cheeses were available all through the 70s. Then something called blue imperial pears. And I remember this really well. We bought cases of blue imperial red from, was it Morris's or was it one of the other Rutherglen producers? It was a wine, we at Celador loved it. 3 years later, I'm drinking it and thinking, I don't want to drink this. And then discovered, I didn't want to drink with it, I didn't want to cook with it, but if I poached pears in it, it was stunning. Because I used some spices and orange rind and all of that. So blue imperial pears. That was pretty nice.
That sounds amazing.
And then 10 days later, a fortnight later, lovely people. where I made a chocolate souffle for dessert. And I always had a green salad, which is interesting.
What's interesting to me, though, is that my perception of the 70s is something, you know, I would imagine a menu that involved pineapple, jelly, you know, all the things that we would see on something like that 70s show, let's say.
Okay. Now, jelly for me was kids' parties. I didn't know anyone. Oh, no, I once made... I'm twice made. I never did anything once unless it was a disaster. A port and orange jelly with strawberries. And it wasn't a sweet jelly at all. Mm. It was fabulous. But I decided jelly was essentially for kids' parties. So having perfected it, didn't bother with it ever again. Pineapple? I don't remember anyone cooking with pineapple, but there might have been pineapple on pizzas. The Hawaiian pizza always had pineapple on it. I occasionally had pineapple for dessert, and my favourite pineapple story, I was working at a liquor store in the 70s, and there was a woman of some years who was looking thoughtful, and I said to her, may I help you? And she said, I'm looking for something to go with pineapple. And I said, doubtfully, to drink. And she said, I'm not sure, not quite sure. And I said, well, you can marinate pineapple.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to her, Cointreau, a bit of Cointreau for an hour, and a bit of shredded mint. Be delicious. She said, and then we walked past the chartreuse, and she said, oh, chartreuse. And I said, maybe not with pineapple. And she said, no, when I was little, Cook used to go through a case of that a week.
Oh, God.
So that's my pineapple story from the 70s.
That is very, very interesting to me, Rita, because you are turning my understanding and our understanding, dear listener, of 70s food on its head.
Now, I can only talk for me and my circle, but the dinner party was big. I hated the word dinner party, still do. It's having friends around for a meal.
Mm-hmm.
Quite different in the tone of it. The dinner party is formal and nasty, things happen and people argue with each other. Having friends around for dinner, nobody argues, unless there are a couple of arguments recorded in my book.
Is that something that you can share? No names. Can you tell us some having friends around for dinner stories?
Now, the reason things went wrong was that one couple arrived an hour late.
Mm-hmm.
And so the people who were here, particularly one couple, had drunk rather too much before they arrived, and there were two big male egos, one alcohol-fueled and the other aggressive because embarrassed about being an hour late.
Mm-hmm.
And the note is very simply, X arrived an hour late, Y had too much to drink, they didn't get on.
That's very politically correct, Rita.
Now, the things during the 70s, one was that lots and lots of people had travelled in the 60s and 70s, and they often travelled to France.
Mm.
So everyone was interested in French food, and French food was then still the kind of the standard, the gold standard for fine dining.
And the 70s really were the first time that avocado became readily available in Australia.
That's right.
And
that's
so we right. think as millennials, you know, Gen Y, Gen X, that we discovered and ergo mortgaged our homes in order to have an avocado, you know. Like we're renting so we could have avocado on toast.
So of course, well, I have to tell you, in the 70s, you would have had to pay much more for avocado because they were new and I can't remember how much they were, but if I had them, I think I do. I could go back through those Sun records and find out what things cost. They were new, they were interesting. There's a menu from somewhere. Half an avocado was served as an entree.
I seem to recall you mentioning Miettas.
Yeah, it was Miettas at Queenscliff where half an avocado was served as an entree with olive oil.
And that was it.
And olive oil was... the Australian industry was just getting going again commercially because the first olive oil in Victoria, well, commercial olive oil was grown, I think, in the late 40s. And then in the 60s, on much the same site, around the Grampians, someone started producing olive oil again.
Israelis, right? I think it was Israelis that planted the first.
I think they were.
Yeah,
that's right.
Which is now Mount Zero.
Beautiful. And as Israelis, an Israeli planted the first olives in New Zealand, in Marlborough. I spoke to his wife. She said he'd come from Jerusalem. He was seven generations. You're showing me, and came to New Zealand because of her, and looked at the hills, bare hills of Marlborough, and said, "Need olives," and planted olives.
So let's talk about hors d'oeuvres.
Mm-hmm.
Olives brings me to a very interesting question in my mind, because the 70s to me, finger food, sharing.
Oh, lots of finger food. Not so much sharing, just finger food, I think. And the real place to go to for what people were eating would be the Women's Weekly cookbooks, which were extraordinary because everything worked. Everything was tested and tested and tested. You couldn't go wrong. You might not always have wanted to eat the food, but it was always right. And I think they had a lot of hors d'oeuvre and stuff. And I'm pretty sure of that because years and years later, at a friend's place, he was doing all sorts of things. And I said, "Oh, how funny, that looks so 70s. He said, "I'm cooking it from the Women's Weekly cookbook."
Restaurants like Miettas, Stephanie's and Flower Drum were cropping up, but it was nothing like the restaurant scene in Melbourne today. So dinner parties really provided the only opportunity for people to flex their foodie muscle.
So we have a little bit of time left. I want to talk about the notion of dinner party as competitive cooking.
I think for many, many people, it was competitive cooking. It was they went to so much trouble, we'll have to do better. So that it was the domestic version of My Kitchen Rules. And that's why... I think so many people snarl, you know, women of my age snarl a bit when you mention dinner parties, and they say, I'm over all of that, I'm not doing that again. But if you say to them, look, when you have family or friends around for dinner, oh yeah, that's different. So you take the competitive element out and it's fine. And there was, around some tables, there certainly was a lot of competition going on in all sorts of ways. There were people who thought they knew more about wine than anyone else and were determined to show their burgeoning wine knowledge, so that wine became a competitive sport, and as it is now, essentially, for many people. And the, you know, how much effort you could go to was an evidence of your cooking skills. So it was, for lots of people, exhausting. And if you didn't get your the mix of guests right, there were terrible rows around the table because you got egos clashing and people snarling at each other, particularly if they'd had too much to drink to start with. This is why you need finger food and hors d'oeuvre. You need to get people eating at the same time as they're drinking.
That's a good tip. That's a pro tip. I suppose your tip then, for a really good dinner party, is to think of the guests as much as the food as a set of ingredients.
That's right. That's right. Would you put these ingredients together? Weird, but it might work.
Well, it sounds like it would be an interesting dinner party to put some fascinating, different, conflicting flavours together, and that's probably what we're going to get at Abigail's party.
Yes, I'm going to be very, very interested in that and what is served up in terms of ideas, because there was always a lot of talking. And that was the lovely. I've always judged a good meal on the quality of the conversation. People who are unhappy or hungry or will argue. People who are busy enjoying food, their blood sugar levels are fine. They're not cranky. There's always going to be half an avocado. You sent me that image, still with the stone in, and I thought, who leaves an avocado stone in to serve an avocado?
It's avant-garde, Rita.
Avant-garde. But you take it out, and if it hasn't been, if it's been wild grown, you can plant the seed and you might get an avocado tree. It was interesting. I had a very dear friend in the 70s who always served the same thing, and it was always lovely. And she said to me, you can cook anything you like, I can't. I cook what I'm confident about.
Well, let's finish with her menu. What did she cook?
We always had beef fillet. She always had spinach with lots and lots of butter. There were potatoes, but I can't remember how she cooked them. There were always cheeses. We usually started with soup. And her son-in-law is Will Studd.
Oh. And that's a story for another day.
That's a story for another time.
And that is a great place to finish, Rita, because this, as conversations go, was quite the dish. Thank you very much.
We have to do second helpings.
We must. Thank you for tuning in, and we will see you at opening night.
We will.